Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest is Wake Forest men's golf coach, Jerry Haas. Jerry is from a great, great golf family. In fact, one of the best golf families I've ever known. His uncle, Bob Golby, won the Masters. Obviously, his brother, Jay, had an incredible career on the PGA Tour and Champions Tour. And his nephew, Bill, has obviously been a great player as well. So he comes from a great family, and Jerry was a great player himself. So we're going to talk about his career as a player, his career at Wake Forest, and then all about his coaching there at Wake Forest the last 25 years. I think Jerry's a very interesting guy, great storyteller, and just a really good guy in the game of golf. So I hope you enjoy the listening. All right, Better Than I Found It listeners, let's give a big welcome to Wake Forest men's golf coach, Jerry Haas. Jerry, thanks so much for taking time to be with me on Better Than I Found It today.
Coach McGraw, you're the best. I was very honored that you called me and asked me to do this, and look forward to talking about the golf, professional, college, anything doing with it. It's a great sport.
It is that you are totally right about that, but you've always been one of my favorite college coaches. I think you're an incredibly interesting guy. You are, but also you come from a playing background to begin with, which is intriguing to me how there's a big flip going from being a player to a coach, and it's different. And so we'll talk about that in a bit, but let's start by just talking about your current team. I know you guys are ranked 35th in the country in golf stat right now. And just tell me what you've got remaining. Where's the ACC championship? Tell me about your team.
We have got the Floridian coming up next week, which is always a great event, a strong field. And after that, we go to Colusa Pines down in Naples. Then we have a little bit of a break. And then our ACC this year, we've started a rotation, and it'll be at the Country Club in North Carolina on the Dogwood course. So really good golf course. You should have the top teams, should make the match play there. It's a field separator. It's a really good golf course right in front of you. So we've got three events left. We need to improve a little bit. We had a slow fall, and we played much better this spring. And the guys know it. We're a little bit below the 500 rule. So we need to have a nice finish here towards the end. And I feel like we will. They're working extremely hard at it. And some of my better players are starting to play well again, which always helps.
Well, you've got a great team. And you know, a lot of people are conflicted about that 500 rule. And I'm not talking about whether it should exist or not. I'm talking about when your team is in danger. Last year we missed at Baylor. It was the first time I've ever missed a regional in my whole career. It was very early in the second semester where we kind of realized we were behind the eight ball and it wasn't going to happen. And I didn't pay too close of attention to it, but it's obvious you've already talked with your players about it. Describe that a little bit.
Well, I just, explained to them that, hey, as a coach here at Wake Forest and Coach Aaron O'Callaghan, the associate head coach, it's our job to get to regionals and give you guys the best opportunity. That being said, I don't want to underschedule. I don't want to run away from good competition. It's such a fine line. You look at a lot of teams will play in an event that's got 24 teams or something that's pretty weak, and you can kind of build your over 500 in 1 week right there. But we didn't play very well in the fall, quite frankly. So they knew it, and we talked about it before we left here for the break. And we said, guys, we're behind. And they kind of think, oh, well, yeah, it's no big deal. We'll pick that up. But you need to play well. Every shot saved. You know, if you can move up three spots the last day from fifth to second or eighth to fifth, that makes a huge difference throughout the year. So if you want to be any good at this game, if you want to move on to the next level, if you want to be successful in life, you need a little pressure. You need to know what you're up against and not just like, oh, I didn't know what was going on. They're well aware of it, and they're treating it in a professional manner, and they're working very hard at it. So
well, I applaud you for two things. One, for not hiding from it. I think that's good that they know it. Life's about competition. You're going to be competing at something the rest of your life. But number two, you didn't dumb down your schedule. You still have a really, really good schedule. And I think that speaks to your players. You believe in them and trust them enough to keep that schedule. Now, I realize it's possible to overschedule. If I've got a team where I graduate five and next year I've got five freshmen, I mean, maybe you adjust the schedule a little bit, but you haven't run away from it. That's great.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, listen, it's impossible to do an interview with you, I think, without mentioning your family. You guys are one of the great golf families, maybe in the history of golf, period. So let's talk about a few of those. I'm going to let you go through, starting with your uncle Bob, Bob Golby, who won the Masters in 1968. That's a pretty good start as far as a golf family.
What a great man. He, 11 tour wins, Masters champion, runner up at the, 61 US Open, 62 PGA, was a really, really great player, self-taught. He, went to Illinois on a football scholarship. And as you told me, then he later played baseball for Southern Illinois, but then became ineligible. But he was just a great athlete. And he always told me, you didn't tell anybody you played golf back in his era. It was kind of a sissy sport. You know, you had to play baseball and basketball and football. And he would sneak over the golf course and get kicked off all the time, sneak over and at St. Clair Country Club in Belleville, Illinois. And he put a bed sheet over a clothesline, and he put Ben Hogan's Five Fundamentals of Golf on the ground right next to him. And he hit balls into the bed sheet 10, 15 feet in front of him and dropped down. And his parents thought, man, there's something wrong with our son here. But he just loved it. Turned pro later in life, 27 years old. He 6 months later, he birdied the last two holes over here at Starmount Country Club in Greensboro, North Carolina. He won the Greensboro Open, and he beat Sam Snead, Art Wall, Champagne Tony Lima, Don January, and I mean, I don't know who the fifth guy was, but he beat him by a shot, and they put his name up there, and I guess Sam Snead said, who the heck is Bob Golby? He went up to him. He said, hello, Mr. Snead, I'm Bob Golby, and they became lifelong friends. They played practice rounds together. They were great friends, but he got us started, and he ran into Coach Jesse Haddock, the great legendary coach at Wake Forest, three national championships, and he said, my nephew's a really good player. And Coach Haddock tells me the story later. He says, everybody's nephew's a really good player. And that I found out that Jay Haas was pretty good. So my brother Jay, 10 years older than me, and he went to Wake Forest to play for Coach Haddock. They were just okay as a freshman, as he was a freshman. But then the next year, Curtis Strange came in and kind of got things rolling. It turned out to be a kind of a juggernaut in college golf at that time, along with Oklahoma State and Texas and Arizona. So he went to Wake Forest, and I was 10 years younger, and he was my idol. So I wanted to go to Wake Forest, and luckily I was good enough. And 10 years later, I went to Wake and played for Coach Haddock. And unbelievable time of my life, you know, unbelievable part of my career. And I played then for 12 years and decided that I just wasn't making enough, and had some moments here and there. But at the same time, I just had a daughter that was born. And I said, you know, I need to do something a little bit more stable here. And luckily, the job opened. I talked to Ron Wellman, who was the athletic director at that time. And I said, look, I've never coached, but I'm not here to be your basketball coach or your football coach, but I do know golf. I do know what golf is all about. I've seen my brother play at a high level. I've worked with my uncle Bob, because at that point in time, my brother Jay was a pro. In those formative years of 14, 15, 16, 17, my uncle was still around, and he was my teacher basically all my life. And he taught me some great things about the game. And so as moving forward, I love to give back. He gave me so much time. It was unbelievable how much we would weed eat the yard or cut the grass. And then he'd say, come on, let's go play a few. And he always was sharing. And I felt like to be a good coach, you had to be able to give of yourself a little bit. You had to kind of give your knowledge without forcing it down somebody's throat. Because, you know, as a player, not everything you get is correct. You know, you have to sift through it and decide what works for you and what doesn't. So I said, you know, I told Ron Wellman, I said, I think I'd be a great coach because it's not about me. I've lived that moment, but I want kids that want to share that dream, and I want to help them achieve those dreams. So luckily I got the job. And as my brother Jay told me, he's like, Bill had it all figured out. Uncle Jerry's going to get the job. Then I'm going to go to Wake Forest and play for him. So my nephew, Bill Haas, came here and played for us, and kind of got things rolling the right way. And he was, you know, an All-American and first team All-American, player of the year. And he was just really, really good. He was very talented. And if you look at his scores right when he came here in school, you'd never, if you read him off, you'd say, man, that guy's no good. He started a little slow, but he won once as a freshman, twice as a sophomore, three times as a junior, and then five times as a senior, and still has the all-time record for stroke average for a year. That it'll be a tough one to break because he was very consistent. I was looking, he had 13 rounds in a row in the 60s at one time, and then he had another stretch of 11, another stretch of 10 during his career. So as the late Richard Sykes, the coach at NC State, he said, he's an eraser. Every time a guy makes a bogey, Bill can make a birdie to make up for it. So I always,
Richard Sykes,
what a man.
What a man, Richard Sykes. Well, yeah. So that's your Uncle Bob, your brother, Jay, your nephew, Bill, you had another nephew, Jay Haas Jr., who played at Augusta State, and your brother-in-law, Dillard Pruitt, who played the PGA Tour. I mean, this is a golf family.
Yeah, no question about it. Yeah, Dillard, if you count Dillard in there, we've played in over 2,000 PGA Tour events, and that's not counting the Champions Tour. And my brother's won 18 times out there and been player of the year and three majors, and he's really good.
Jay Tell Austin. This. I fancy myself a little bit of a golf historian. At one time, he had the most cuts made in the history of the PGA Tour. I don't know if he still has it. Is that still a record?
Oh, yeah, it's still a record. He's got two more than Tom Kite. And Tom used to sneak out there a little bit. And I talked to Jay probably three, four times a week. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm keeping an eye on him. But now he's gotten to the point where he's much older and he doesn't try to play the tour events. But Kite kept sneaking out there trying to make a cut here or there. And I said, well, what are you going to do if he catches it? He said, oh, I'm going to have to go play a few myself. So he actually did make it. I don't know if you count that. He played with Bill last year in the team thing, and they made the cut, which I thought was pretty cool. Jay said he had about a 4-footer on the last hole to make the cut, and he said it felt like it was about a 40-footer, man. He said, I've never been more nervous over a putt. And I mean, here's a guy that's, you know, played all his life and played at a high level, and just the importance of playing with your son.
Yeah, that's actually an incredible moment. I remember that last year, and I think they did add it to his record, but I wasn't positive if it still lasted. That's going to be a hard record to beat because of the longevity of it. And every time a kid says, well, Jay didn't win a major or whatever on the PGA Tour, it's like, I don't know how many times he shot 67 in the final round at Augusta, but it was several. And to play that well, that consistently, that long is an amazing accomplishment. So, I mean, you played professional golf, you know how hard it was.
Right. Yeah, he played almost 800 events. And I don't know how many he's played on the Champions Tour, but I think that's a record that'll probably never be broken just because guys don't play as much.
Yep.
You know, they're tired now, or, oh, I got to take a week or two off. But it wasn't that way back in the day. You played, you know, if you had an event to play, you played. So he doesn't have the most starts, though. The most starts is Mark Brooks has more starts than Jay because he was a PGA champion. So he got to play about 10 or 12 extra times as the PGA champion. So that's why he's got him there.
Actually, I knew that. I was walking a fairway with Mark last summer at the State Junior. He was watching a kid that he works with now. And he told me that. And I said, you know, I knew you'd played a long time, but I did not realize. Did you know Mark's teaching right now?
I did not, no.
Yeah. Yeah. He's teaching a lot of people down here, but he teaches in Fort Worth and he teaches in Austin. So he does both, but yeah, pretty good longevity record there himself. So it's obvious the family thing, you came by it honestly, and you had a really good amateur career. You won the Illinois State Amateur a couple of times. You were second team All-American at Wake, played in the Masters, made the cut in 1985, and you were on the Walker Cup team at Pine Valley. I can't imagine a more exciting place to have a Walker Cup at Pine Valley, you know, your senior year in college. That's pretty impressive. Talk about that experience.
That was really incredible. I'd heard all these mythological things about this Pine Valley golf course. And it's funny, later in life, people have asked me, have you ever played Pine Valley? And I'm like, yeah, I played there. And they kind of like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, I played there about 6 days in a row. I said, probably the hardest course I've ever played. And they go, what do you mean? I'm like, well, I was on the Walker Cup team. And, you know, Scott Verplank was on that team. Duffy Waldorf, Davis Love III, Sam Randolph, for those that know golf, I mean, man, he was probably our best player. He was really, really good. Duffy Waldorf, I mentioned. Jay Sigel was the playing captain. Clark Burrows was a nice player out of Ohio State. So we had a really, really good team, and we ended up winning by a shot. I remember that Colin Montgomery was, I think he was maybe 20 years old, went to Houston Baptist, but he was kind of the best player, and Peter Baker on the Great Britain and Ireland team. So what a great place. They still, believe it or not, have little things up on the wall there. And if I ever go back and want to play, the president said, as long as I'm the president, you can come back and play. So I've played maybe a couple times there in the last, 35 years. So,
Jared, you've got an open invitation to play Pine Valley. Come on. What are you doing?
Hey, I got to tell you that we went up there for regionals at Galloway National. Okay. We went up there probably 2010-ish. And I played in the Walker Cup there in 1985. Okay. I played one time since in 1988 or 1989. So I go back there and I play the guys. We have five players and a coach. I had no assistant at that time. So we played two threesomes, and I said, all right, I'll play y'all each and every way. And I played very nicely, and I won every single bet, front, back, total, off all the players. and then we get in the van, and the one guy goes, well, it wasn't fair, though. I mean, you've played this course. We've never played it before. I said, I played it, let's see, 1985, 95, oh, 25 years ago I played it. Come on, don't tell me it wasn't fair. So anyway.
That's another thing a college player doesn't understand. 25 years, that's a lot of abuse to your body.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Doesn't feel the same. Okay, I'm going to ask the question before we move on. Great amateur career, which led you to the professional ranks. But did you ever consider going anywhere else but Wake Forest? I know your older brother Jay went there. Was there anybody else recruiting you? How did that work?
Illinois recruited me. Obviously, I was from Belleville, Illinois, right near St. Louis, and I did get a call one night from Mike Holder at Oklahoma State, and it was a great conversation. He's like, well, what are you looking for in college? And I'm like, I don't know, great school. And yeah, what else? I don't know, good golf courses. Yeah, what else? I'm like, you know, finally I started laughing. I'm like, I don't know, pretty girls, you know, or whatever. No, what else? And I didn't know what he was looking for. And he goes, aren't you looking for competition? And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm definitely looking for competition. He's like, well, we have it here and blah, blah, blah. And he offered me a half a scholarship, and I think we could afford it. I don't know. I mean, I went to Wake Forest. I want to say it was like $3,500 a semester back in 1981, which it's not that now. I wish it was. It'd be a little easier to recruit, but
wouldn't it though?
But anyway, so that was just very few places had recruited me. I was lucky. I won the Illinois State High School my senior year, and I tell people I beat Tom Watson by four shots, and they look at me and they think, oh yeah, I could see that, Tom Watson. But it wasn't the same Tom Watson. It was a guy from Libertyville, Illinois, named Tom Watson. I beat him by four. But
well, I didn't know there was another Tom Watson. The real Tom Watson is 25 years older than you, basically.
That, I know, but a lot of people don't figure that out. They look at me like, oh yeah, Kansas City, Illinois, I could see that happening. And I'm like, no.
So you mentioned him earlier, and I want to talk about him before we move on. Jesse Haddock, Hall of Fame coach, won three national championships, coached two of what are regarded as two of the best teams, 1974 and 75, in the history of college golf. And tell me, what was the best qualities of Jesse? And is there any part of your coaching you think has been influenced by his influence on you?
I would say his best quality was he knew people. He knew how to push the buttons, if you will. He knew that I need to get on this guy a little bit. I need to back off this guy a little bit. He was a great judge of character, people, surroundings, if you will, the environment, what was going on. Back then, as you remember, I mean, coaches didn't really go on the course. You just kind of met you at the turn and, hey, how you doing? And all right, keep it up. Or, hey, you need to get going here a little bit. So it was different, but yet you knew you had respect for him, and you knew you needed to play hard, and you needed to do things the right way. You know, we wore long pants when others wore shorts, and we still wear long pants. It's one tradition I've kept, and I think it's a wonderful. He used to say, you know, Shorts is for junior golf, and now you want to be a pro, or you want to be a young professional, or play the tour, you need to start learning how to wear long pants. And great story that one guy came in and said, "Coach, I want to wear shorts." And he told him, he's like, "That's right. You wear your shorts, you go back to your country club, you ride your cart, you swill your beer." Those were his words. "You swill your beer." He said, "You shoot your 75s. He's like, "Curtis and Lanny, they wear long pants and shoot 67s on Sunday." That was the end. That's a true story. That kid told me that. I was like, "Oh man." But he just was really great. And I guess one of the things that, you know, I had a lot of lunches, and he was still around Winston-Salem when I first took the job, and he would come by and stuff. He was very intense man. He was very, very, very devoted to Wake Forest and the job and the profession. And he was very competitive, which I, you know, I think I get that as well. I want to have a chance. You know, I know how golf works. You know how golf works. You might have the best team and you don't win, or just because you have a bad day or whatever, but you want to have that chance. And when you roll off campus, which is the best part for me, is rolling off campus and heading to a tournament and saying, "All right, let's see what we got here. Let's see where we're at. Let's see how these kids have developed." And that's the best part of coaching by far. And that's something that he really instilled in me. And the fact that, you know, the behind the scenes is great, but it's the competition. It's the getting out there with the players. That's the best part.
Well, you know, that's good that you say that. I think all of us, if we're paying attention, we have mentors or people that kind of give us something. Well, it's obvious he gave you that, which is great. But his last national championship, 1986, was in Winston-Salem at Bermuda Run. And Mike Holder, when I got to Oklahoma State, I was going through the media guide and just talking to him about this, that, and the other. And without fail, without question, his most disappointing loss. And he was runner-up 10 times in the national championship, on top of winning it 8 times. So he had incredible success. But 1986 at Bermuda Run was his most disappointing loss ever. He had the individual champion, Scott Verplank. He had two other guys on the team, E.J. Pfister and Brian Watts, who would both be NCAA champions the following 2 years. And Michael Bradley won on the tour, and Tim Fleming, a nice player from Mississippi. He had a great team. Now, you did as well, and I know you played on the team that fall and graduated. Tell me about those guys, and tell me about that NCAA championship they won.
16 back the last day. They had a very poor third round, which kind of made it look like they had no chance. And they had a nice meeting, Coach Attic told me, the night before. And you had seniors were Billy Andrade and Chris Kite. Chris Kite, first-team All-American, lost in the finals to Buddy Alexander in the U.S. Amateur. So he was a really fine player. And obviously Billy Andrade was my roommate for 3.5 years and had a great week this week on the Champions Tour. I always follow Billy and still talk to him. And then they had three freshmen, Barry Fabian, who was a nice player from Ohio, Lenny Matisse, who ended up doing good things on the tour, and Tim Straub, who was the U.S. Junior champion and runner-up U.S. Junior, and he was a freshman, and he's now the coach at Davidson. So they just shot 43 under last week. Davidson did. Tim's got them going the right way. They've won conference title there 2 of the last 4 years. So they're good. So if you look back, and I think you'd agree with this, and when you look back on teams and you look at pictures and you look at names, and then they go on and do things in golf, you're like, "Oh, no wonder we were pretty good." You know, and then other teams look at it and you're like, "Oh, well, he's doing this, he's doing that." Very successful in other areas, but yet you look back and say, "Ah, no wonder that was." Now, going back to Tim Fleming, a freshman, I played with Tim a lot. He was great. EJ was great. Brian Watts was a really good player. But sometimes, and in this case, maybe they weren't ready for that. You know, you said later they ended up winning. And sometimes as a coach, as you know, it's got a lineup. You might have a really good freshman, but he's just not ready to handle things like the junior and senior. But then junior and senior leaves, and now he gets a little better. It needs to kind of fall together. And Coach Haddock said he did something he's never done. He went and sat out behind the fourth green. And they had a little rain that morning, and the greens looked really, really kind of glistening, if you will. They looked pretty slow. And but he told the guys, he's like, "They're not really slow." He's like, you got to make sure you get those putts there, because the guys are going to be leaving them short because they look slower, but they're really not. And They got off to a nice start and still were well back. And then Chris Kite shot 30 on the backside, hold a shot on 13. Tim Straub made two birdies at the end to shoot 74, actually, but made birdie on 16 and 17, part 18. Billy Andrade shot 69, 66 for Chris Kite, and a 69 for Lenny Matisse. So it was just kind of, it all came together the last nine, and Oklahoma State was maybe reeling a little bit, and they made up, they ended up winning by four. So it really stinks as a coach, as we know, when things, the wheels start coming off. You can't get a, hey, you can't get a 20-second timeout, or you can't pull a guy out and put somebody else in. It's what you got out there, and you better hope they hang on.
Yeah, and that's where you hope the preparation you've done kind of does the job. And in that case, it was meant to be. Wake Forest was going to win the title that day. And obviously, both teams had players that went on to do great things in the game. So you play a 12-year, basically 12-year career. I want, everybody knows about the Battlefield promotion from the either Hogan Tour, Web.com, Nationwide, whatever you want to call it, Corn Ferry now. When you win three times, there was a Battlefield promotion, but it was not there when you were playing, but you kind of were the precursor to that. Talk about the 1994 season when you won three times.
Well, I was playing, you know, I'd played 90, 91 on the tour and a little bit of 92, and then didn't putt very well and just kind of lost my card and played here or there. In 94, I didn't have any status, and so I started to try to Monday qualifier, and I think I missed the first seven. And then I finally got in and I finished fourth, and then I finished sixth or something. And then anyway, I started playing a little better, started getting some status. Then all of a sudden I my putter was bad. I missed 11 cuts in a row, middle of August, $2,200 I'd made all year. And obviously spent way more than that. I didn't have a sponsor. I was, you know, paying my own way and newly married, and like, oh man, this is not going very well. And I was staying in private housing in Springfield, Missouri, and there was a Golf Digest magazine there. So I started looking at it, and there was an article in there by Bernhard Langer, putt like me. You know, I had the yips or whatever. So he had a longer putter and it went up his arm, and then he clamped it, you know, the Bernhard style. And I'm like, well, it can't be any worse. So I go to the course the next day and I see Cricket Mush, and he was the ping rep and a great college coach. I mean, man, that's been around golf. And I said, Cricket, here's what I want to do. So he lengthened a putter for me and I stuck it up my arm and I went out there on the putting green, and man, 30 footer made it, 35 footer, 20 footer, 6 footer. I mean, I'm just making putts all over the place. I'm like, well, it can't be any worse. So I go out there and I shoot 65 the first day, 69 the second day. Maybe in third place. And I make the cut. I'm like, all right, I finally made a cut. So I call my brother up, this four cell phones. I call him up and I said, hey, I made the cut. And he says, well, what's going to win? I'm like, oh, I don't know, probably like 20 under. He's like, well, I don't know why you're so happy. You still got 10 more to go. And I'm like, man, what a jerk. You know, I finally made a cut 3 months and now he's telling me that, but he was right. You know? So anyway, I played nice the third day. I shoot 69. And a little side story, I get on the tee the last day and I'm playing with David Duval. It was like his second event maybe. And this guy's really good, just coming out of Georgia Tech. And I've got a black Titleist 4 with a gold dot on it. Well, at that time, a yellow dot with the Sharpie for Wake Forest, black and yellow. And I always played the number of the day. And he gets on the tee and he's got a Titleist 2 with a yellow dot for Georgia Tech, black and yellow. And he says to me, he goes, you need to change. And I looked at my ball. I'm like, well, why do I need to change? He goes, I'm the only one marked with the yellow dot. And I said, how old are you? And he's like, I'm 23. And I said, well, I'm 31 and I've been doing it 8 years longer than you and I'm not changing. And I said, hi, the true story. I said, we never spoke the whole day. And I said, besides, I've got a 4 and you got a 2. And anyway, I chip in on the first hole to tie him. Anyway, we battled the whole day and I end up making about a 12 footer on the last hole for birdie to beat Frank Connor by one. Frank Connor's across the pond there on the putting green. And I all I could think of over it was, man, I could use the cash. And I hit a beautiful putt and made it. And so I ended up winning there. And then I beat Duval again later in the year at Tri-Cities about a month and a half later. And then I beat Woody Austin the next week at Sonoma County. So I won three times in 2 months. I think I was 122 under par for those 2 months of golf, and I won three times. I went from 160th on the money list to ninth. So now I got to go to the tour championship, and like a fool, I look at all the money. So if a guy's 38th on the money list and he wins it's 50 grand on top at that time. If he wins the money that he can't pass me, you know, so basically it came down to the guys 10 through 17. If any of them got the big money, I would be bumped out. So I play the third day with Sonny Skinner, and he's in 10th, and I have a really nice day. I shoot 67, and he shoots 82. So I'm like, all right, I think I shook him. I'm up by, there's no way I can give up 15 more tomorrow. But
I got Sonny.
Yeah, big Sonny. I got him. So I'm like, all right, he's not going to pass me. So I start looking at the thing, and I'm like, the only possible way I cannot get in the top 10 is if Lee Rinker wins and Emlyn Aubrey finishes second. And that's the only combination. It can't be a tie, can't be whatever. And what do you know, Mike, on the 71st green, I look over. Now, they've been there all day, fourth, sixth, third, you know, but not first and second. And I look over on the 71st green, and they got the manual thing, and he's moving people around. Lee Rinker on top, Emlyn Aubrey second. I four-putted from 15 feet. I thought I would probably throw up on the 17th green, and I'm like, this is not happening. I make double bogey. And so now I look out and I see Lee Rinker last hole at Pumpkin Ridge there on the other course with the water right. Good hole, straight away par four. And I see him putting from about 8 feet. And I say to the cameraman there, what is he putting for? He said, I think he's putting for bogey. And I'm thinking to myself, man, miss it, you know, miss it. And I watch him from 440 yards away and he misses. So I'm thinking he's not going to win. And then I see Emlyn Aubrey in the middle of the fairway, and he kind of hits it on the green. But I found out later he had already chipped out of the weeds to there. So anyway, I toe hook it in the left rough up there, get it on three putt again, double finish like eighth. But it really didn't matter at that time how much money I was going to make. They were going to pass me if they finished 1-2. And anyway, I ended up getting off the course there, and they both had a bogey and a double at the last, and they dropped back, and Mike Shewhart, who I was playing with, made birdie and won the tournament. And I about kissed him on the last green there, taking all the money. But anyway, so I got my card back after that miraculous end of the year. And I putted better in 95, but I just didn't hit it as well. So okay. I knew it was about time to do something else.
Before we move on to that something else, which is college golf, how much interaction did you have with Jay? I mean, you said you called him one time, but I mean, did you all play practice rounds together when you were on the tour? How did that all work?
Not too often. No, we stayed together on occasion. I ran in a little lower rent district than him. I remember one time he had to run, get a new pillow and a new bar of soap because the bars of soap were too small and the pillows weren't right. So that was the 1 week with me. And he's, I think I'm going to stay over here next week. I'm like, that's fine. I'll stay where I'm staying. But I remember one time playing the Hawaiian Open, we were paired together, and there was two Japanese guys looking at the pairing sheet. And the one said, and I was listed from Belleville, Illinois, and he was listed from South Carolina. And the one guy said, Jay Haas, Jerry Haas, brothers? And the other one said, can't be, different place. So they did, you know, a lot of people think he's my dad, to be honest with you. But
well, I mean, honestly, I think the very first time I ever saw your name back in the early to mid 80s, I didn't know it wasn't, right. You didn't make connection, but I thought maybe a cousin. I didn't know you were his brother, which is great. 10 years removed. But, you know, so in 1997, you were ready for something new, and yep. It became the head coach at Wake Forest, your alma mater. So overnight you go from player to coach, and you mentioned this earlier. It was kind of like, that's a different thing, but I want to know, how do you go from being a selfish player, which is what we are when we're playing, I've got to do everything for me so I can be good, to giving everything of yourself to the player? How does that happen overnight?
Well, it goes back a little bit. I think that I mentioned that my uncle was so giving with his time and his energy and his expertise, and completely different era. He would tell me to work on something, and I would work on it for 3 weeks while he was on the road. He was working for NBC as an on-course commentator. He was playing a little bit himself, and he'd come back and I'm like, what do you think of that? And he's like, no. He called me a donkey. No, you donkey, that's wrong. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I just worked on it 3 weeks. So he'd tweak it a little bit more, the grip or whatever, the footwork, whatever it was. And then he'd disappear again for 2-3 weeks. And then, yeah, that's getting a little better. So you kind of had to figure it out yourself. And I would say my coaching style is I don't overcoach. I mean, you look at the best players today, none of them swing alike. None of them act alike. As my brother Jay always said, a great golf swing is one that can produce the shot under pressure. That's mm-hmm. a great that it doesn't have to look. If it was so about aesthetics and how good it looks, then you'd have other guys that, you know, Gene Littlers and Tom Pertscher and the Adam Scotts and the ones that, oh, we just marvel at how beautiful they swing at it. Jessica Korda, they're talking a lot about her right now. But if that was the case, it was all just about how you looked, then they would win every time and no one else would win. But it's not the case. You have people that are digging down deep within themselves to craft a shot or get through a moment during the round that's going to help them win or lose the tournament or whatever, but the trust they have in their ability and what they've worked on. And that's one of the things that he really instilled, my uncle, is you have to kind of figure it out yourself. I can't be there to hold your hand. I can try to help you. I could be your best cheerleader, whatever. But at the end of the day, you have to figure it out yourself.
Gosh, good coaching right there, honestly. And you're coaching at your alma mater. Got to have a great amount of pride there. Alan Bratton is coaching at Oklahoma State at his alma mater. There are several examples of it, but that's got to be special.
Oh, so special. I am very thankful. The word I try to use around here with the guys, you know, we always talk about attitude, this and that, but my big A word is appreciative. I think you have to be appreciative of what you have, the opportunity here at Wake, the opportunity at whatever school you go to. Be appreciative of all the good things that people do for you. And, you know, I live through them. And in a sense, I try to guide them, and, you know, they fail or they do this or that, or they don't, they have their ups and downs, but you got to stick with the plan and keep motivating them and keep encouraging them. And it's a little different. I don't think you can kind of get on them as much as you used to. You have to be, you have to really watch what you say and really have to be, it's a shame, actually, because golf is hard. You know, golf is very difficult, and there's not many people that can help you when it's not going well. You have to really be able to help yourself, and sometimes being a little bit stronger or a little bit being able to take criticism. A lot of them really struggle with the criticism, thinking, "Oh, you're just on me to be on me." I'm not on you to be on you. I want you to do well. It makes me look good. It makes the school look good. It makes everybody's happy if you do well. So you have to be able to allow coaches to coach you and to be constructive of what you need to get better at. And the good ones, they get better at it. They listen and they don't take it the wrong way, and they take it to heart, and they get better at it. The bad ones are just trying to find an excuse. Oh, well, he screwed me up. I've said this many times. You might agree or disagree, but there's never been a college coach that has kept a kid from being a great player.
Not one time.
Not one time.
You know, I think kids get a little mixed message or confused. It's like, I may not always say the right thing to you. It may not always be the perfect thing you wanted to hear, but it's always said with the intent of making you better every single time. And so if you have that attitude, it might be uncomfortable. I mean, I remember some things Mike Holder said to me when I was his assistant and when I was the head coach and he was the athletic director. They were uncomfortable, but apparently I needed to hear him at the time, right?
Right. So, well said, Mike. Well
thank
said.
Thank you. Well, early in your career, I was the assistant coach at Oklahoma State. And I'm going to say publicly this story that you and I have shared 1,000 times. So I'm in those days, you can only have one coach coaching at a time. And so Mike Holder was walking with Hunter Mahan. And he said, go watch the other guys. And I don't even know how I came upon it, but it was Bill's group. Bill Haas, your nephew. And on the second hole, a par 5 at Old Overton, it's kind of one of those kind of valley-shaped fairways where you've got, you know, deep sides on both sides. It kind of funnels, except there had some rough on the right side. And he pushed his tee ball into the right rough. Now, how many times have I told you this story?
We've heard it a lot, but I love hearing it. Okay. I was there. We were there.
Anyway, I was looking, and he had wind off the right. Now, there's a big hill to his right and tons of trees, but there is wind coming through there off the right. He's got 250 yards, right in there, out of some rough, not a lot of rough, but enough rough you can't really control the ball very well. The wind's off the right. And he's got to start the ball left edge of the green to even have a chance, because if he tries to start it right of that, he's going to hit a tree. So I'm thinking, I'm walking with him. I'm telling him, just hit the 8-iron down there. We'll wedge it up there. No problem. And he's got a 2-iron out. And I'm thinking, I got to see this. This is from rough. Wind's off the right. Ball's above his feet. There's no way he could. This is way left in the trees. And he hit an absolute missile with this 2-iron that never thought he was going to leave the flag. 8 foot for eagle. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I can quit coaching right now because I've seen the best shot I'm ever going to see.
Yeah, that
and
was.
I know you told him that story, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I've told him that. And yeah, you're right. I think I wanted him to go up the fairway. He's like, no, I'm just going to cut it. I'll just cut it around there. I'm like, well, all right. You know, if you think so. And he did. And I think we both kind of made eye contact with each other. like, oh, wow, that was pretty good. You know,
what are we doing? So, there's no way that shot can be hit.
Hey, and then the best part of the story, we went up to the next tee, was the downhill par 3.
Right.
And Ricky Barnes was up there with Chris Nallen. And they both had the same clubs, same pings, same everything. And there was a weight on the tee. And Ricky Barnes hit first, and he ended up hitting Chris Nallen's 8-iron instead of his own 8-iron. So he ended up getting a 2-shot penalty, and because he hit it, and then once he hit it, he looked at it and realized, this is not my club. And so then he was all mad at Chris Nallen. Chris is like, oh, whoa, that was my bag over there. So anyway, pretty good.
That happened
story.
Right after that, is what you're right saying.
Right after we walked up to the next tee. So.
Well, I'm going to say publicly right here and right now, the greatest shot in the history of college golf was Bill Haas at Old Overton in the fall of 2002. It was an amazing golf shot. I'll never forget it as long as I live. By the way, you mentioned his scoring average his senior year, 68.93. I'm just not sure how you're going to better that. I know scoring records are pretty vulnerable, but that's pretty incredible.
Very, very solid that year. Like I said, he won 5 times. He finished runner-up at the NCAA, lost to Ryan Moore at the Homestead. And I walked 2 practice rounds because Ryan was an individual and Bill was an individual with Jeff Overton and Ryan Moore and Bill. And then they got paired together, and then Bill and Ryan. So I saw Ryan play 6 straight days, and he played. I mean, his divots were about this long. And so Ryan Moore really – that was the summer he played. I mean, he was really, really playing some golf. He turned out to be a great player and still is a great player. But that was pretty impressive. Bill played very nicely, but Ryan ended up beating him.
Yeah, I remember that golf course was wet that week too, and very hilly, and very wet. But so, you know – Bill was your first elite player, your nephew was. And so he kind of helped you get your feet underneath you. You had been coaching a couple of years before he got there. But you got a really good player right there afterwards named Webb Simpson, who is a good friend of mine and one of the greatest guys that's playing the game of golf today, Webb Simpson. Tons of great qualities about this guy. And he was playing well this past week as well.
Yep, finished 7th, had a nice week.
Another good week. But – Webb Simpson, when he came on this podcast a couple of years ago, he mentioned a meeting because he came out as a number one ranked junior player and his freshman year was kind of underwhelming and his sophomore year had started with kind of average. He wasn't knocking it out of the ballpark like he thought. Talk about that, because he talked about the meeting he had with you as a turning point in his career. Talk about that meeting y'all had just before Christmas break.
Well, back up just a second. He came in the first week, you know, he worked with Ted Kegel over at Carolina Country Club. No problem. I've always respected teachers and I'm just another good pair of eyes. So we didn't talk much about golf the first week or so. And that's when we had the big JC video camera, the big yellow box, and you'd come over and you'd gather around it. So I got the camera off it. And Webb was on the end. And so I zoomed in on his grip. I thought he had a poor grip. He had the long thumb through and he had the fingers here. And as the club went away, it looked like he was playing a flute or something. Those fingers were all moving and the club was, and it just really bothered me. You grew up with Uncle Bob Golby here and man, you better have a good grip and a good setup and good, you know, that was really big to him. So I'm like, I laid in bed basically the first week with Webb, do I say something or don't I say something? You know, he's a, you know, like you say, number one junior, good player. And, but I just, anyway, so I call him over. I'm like, hey, Webb, I want to show you something. First time we've had any, and I show him the grip and he goes, whoa, who is that? That's what he says. And I'm like, that's you. And he goes, no, it's not. I'm like, yes, it is. And he started looking at the glove and he's like, oh my gosh. I'm like, so I went inside and I got him a formed grip, 7-iron. And he had to keep all his fingers on there and it all went on there. And he had probably 15 of the prettiest 7-irons. He goes, well, I can do that. Well, of course, the next day he was out there and it was going back to, you know, he wasn't going to do that. So anyway, so we go forward and right before Christmas and he comes in, and he goes, I want to apologize. And I was like, well, why do you want to apologize? He goes, well, I was this great player and junior, you know, I just haven't won here at Wake. I haven't played the way I should. And I just said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, are you a better player today than you are when you got here? And he's like, oh, yeah, way better. I'm like, okay, well, that's all that matters. I'm like, you're getting better. Continue. Look at yourself every 6 months. And what do I need to get better at? And at the time, I didn't think much of it. I was being honest with him. He was a way better player. And sure, he hadn't won, but I wasn't about that. You know, I was about making each kid better and he was improving. And I remember calling his dad, Sam, maybe late in his junior year, we played one time a little match and I was 5 up with 7 to go. And man, I was just talking to him and he ended up birdieing 6 of the last 7 holes to tie me. I had a putt on 17 to close it out and I missed. He birdied 18. We went an extra hole and then he hit it a foot on the extra hole and beat me in 19 holes. And I still remember that. I called Sam. I said, your son's going to be just fine. He goes, well, I hope so. I'm like, no, he's going to be just fine. I can, not because of that, but I could just tell he was going the right way. So this kid's a player. And so that was that story. And speaking of Sam Simpson and maybe a lesson here for parents or coaching or whatever, Webb, I called him one day and I looked over at my board there and he should have been in class and I could hear his car running. And so I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I'm going home. And it was a Friday. And I said, well, what about class? Well, you know, I've got laundry to do. I want to have lunch with my dad. I want to practice. I've got something I got to do tonight. I'm like, well, yeah, but that's tonight. What time is it? Well, it's at 7 p.m. tonight. I'm like, Webb, it's 9:15 in the morning. So we went back and forth and I don't know what possessed me, but I hung up the phone and I called his dad and I said, Sam, we have a problem. And he goes, what do you got? And so I told him, I said, you know, he misses a lot of class. If he's not there, he needs to, at least when he's missing, I understand, but he should be going when he's in town. He wants to come home and have whatever, lunch with you, and he could do all that stuff. And I didn't say much more. His dad didn't have any excuses, and he just said, it'll be taken care of. And he hung up on me. So now I'm thinking, oh, my God, I got Webb in trouble. Webb's one of my favorite. Now I got him in big trouble. So he came to my office on Monday, and he's like, I see where you're coming from. And I won't miss any more class. I apologize. And I'm like, yeah, I wasn't trying to get you in trouble. I said, just got to understand that it's important. So anyway, he graduated in 4 years. But I thought that was great parenting. No excuses. Sam was not happy with him. He said it'll be taken care of. And as you know, is a fantastic person. Great
well,
kid.
I think that story doesn't surprise me one bit because it Webb is the kind of guy you know had good parents and that held him accountable to the things, but also say it's to his credit that he came in and he wasn't entitled. He had come to on an Arnold Palmer scholarship. He had gotten there and hadn't performed what he thought was earning that scholarship. He came in to apologize to you and you had no idea at the time, but the small words you said was, are you better? Are you better than you were? Yes, sir, I am. Well, that's all I can ask. I'm not asking any more of you. And that conversation changed his career. I mean, I think it changed his career. It took off all the pressure of,
right,
like, I have to play a certain way. No, you just need to get better. That's all. Keep getting better. Really good. I love that story.
42 million. How about that?
Say it again.
42 million he's made or something that.
Just 42 million.
Yeah. What a career.
Oh, what a great career. And just a great guy. He's a perfect example. You can be a really good person and a great player. They're not mutually exclusive. You can do both.
Right.
Let's talk about a couple of more elite players you've coached recently, Will Zalatoris and Cameron Young. I think everybody in the world of golf knows what they've accomplished over the last few years. So we won't have to go through all that. They're two up-and-coming stars. They're great players, are going to be playing pro golf for a long, long time. One, how in the world did you get Will Zalatoris out of Dallas all the way to North Carolina? And two, what are the best qualities of both those two players and why are they going to be successful?
Well, Will, five times he played in the U.S. Junior, just a really, really great ball striker. And as we know in the recruiting, it's sometimes timing. And when that time was coming, he was not playing very well. He was really struggling on the greens. And I went and watched him at the Western Junior, which was actually played at Florida Golf Club or the Golf Club of Florida. Great course, by the way.
I was there.
Yeah. What a course. Never heard of it. And he shot 77, 78 maybe. And I watched him and, man, poor kid couldn't make it from a foot hardly. And I remember leaving and I hear Coach Haas. And I'm kind of looking around and this kid comes running off the patio there where they were having lunch. And, you know, I'm looking around like, oh man, probably not supposed to be talking to this kid. And it was Will. And he just said, hey, I really want to thank you for coming and watching me play. And I'm like, hey, hang in there. You'll be all right. You know, that's about all I said, because here's a guy that myself personally struggled with putting and thinking to myself, he'll figure something out. So we get into recruiting and he really wanted to go to Stanford and they of course passed on him and he, you know, Texas didn't want him. And I when I was talking to him, like, how do we get you out of Texas? He's like, well, I'm not going to go to school in Texas. I'm like thinking, ooh, I got a chance here. So I offered him the AP scholarship, the Arnold Palmer scholarship. And I think I called the AP scholarship. So he tells his dad, I think Coach Haas offered me an academic scholarship, the AP. And his dad's like, no, that's not the academic. That's the Arnold Palmer. So that was kind of the seal of the deal a little bit. And I knew that 99% of this game, in a sense, is you've got to be able to hit it. You know, you can say all you want about mental and, oh, he's really mentally tough. But if you can't play, you can't play, you know. And he could really hit it. And I'm like, we'll figure something out. So before he got here, I said, try something else. Try the claw. So he tried the claw and he shot 59 in Hawaii. And then he won the Texas State Junior. Then he won the Transmiss. And then he won the U.S. Junior. So now all of a sudden he's one of the hottest players. And then he shows up at Wake. And I mean, he's shooting 64s and fives at Bermuda Run like it's, you know, a chip and putt. And as we know, it's not an easy course. And I'm like, man, I got the best player in the country here. And so that's how he ended up at Wake. And his quality is his presence, how he carries himself, what he believes in himself. He used to work on the nine shots, you know, the low straight one, the high one, the middle one, the cut, you know, he could hit all those shots. And I said, man, this guy can hit a 4-iron 245 yards and lands like a sand wedge. And he has a gift. And there's a picture I have on my phone of him at 3.5 years old at the driving range. And it's some of the prettiest positions you've ever seen. You can't see behind me here. I got one of Jay Haas here when he's about 13 with Uncle Bob in the background. And it looks just like Justin Thomas. It's unbelievable. The toes up and the hips are open and, man, just beautiful position. But so anyway, you could really tell from Will that, you know, this kid can play. Now, did he struggle with his putting? Sure. He tried this and that. We used to make him run off the putting green back here and then run back. And, you know, he'd be all out of breath trying to control his emotions and nerves and then he'd putt or whatever. I'm like, all right, run it, you know. But he was such a thin kid. I'm like, this kid's going to weigh 120 pounds if I keep making him run. But he got better and better and better. And the one thing I always said to him was you need to give – the more you give of yourself, Will, the better player you will become. Meaning as a teammate, you know, you shoot the best score, but, you know, maybe Mike played great today. Maybe Jerry played great. Talk to them about their round, you know, get to know them a little bit better. Make them feel opposed to when Mike starts on the first hole about what he did, then all of a sudden you take over. Well, on the first hole I did, you know, you got to give the more. And I think you've seen that with him. He's gotten a little bit more comfortable in who he is. He had the team out to Dallas National when we played there this fall. And I mean, he wasn't playing at the time because of his back, but I mean, could not have been a better host. Told the team stories, gave them all attention and walked with us during the day at Dallas National. And just incredible. The guys were like, man, I've never been around a guy that good that's been that nice, you know. And he just starts to understand a little bit. The more he is not so full of himself, he gets even better and greater. Great ball striker will be as long as he can putt. And he putts very well, even though you say it doesn't look great. His stats are great. And Cameron Young, right into him. Wow, what a talent. Mm. What a talent. Will tells the story because he's a Z in the locker room and Cameron's a Y. It's like our lockers are next to each other. We mess with each other. And he's like, Will's like, I lengthen my driver as long as I can. I got 7 degrees loft and I still can't get it past him. He still hits it about 25 past me. So,
when God was handing out just raw talent, he decided Cameron to get a whole lot, didn't he?
Oh yeah.
And I mean, Cameron,
Cameron won twice as a freshman, comes in my office that fall. He's got a list of 9 things he's written out of what he wants to change with his swing. So I was like, well, we could change them and they might look better, but are they really better? So I call his dad that night, his teacher, Dave Young. And I tell him, and Dave's very soft-spoken. He's like, well, that's why I sent him there. You guys figure it out. And I'm like, that's what he said. And I said, I understand that, but out of respect for you. And he's like, hey, I had an outing today. I'm tired. You guys figure it out. So I thought, wow. Now, there was a dad that obviously taught his son, but knew that at the end of the day, if Cameron's going to be any good, if any player's going to be any good, they kind of have to figure it out for themselves. They have to figure out what works and doesn't work. So, and then all of a sudden he played. He was a nice player, but if it was a dog leg left, Mike, he was in the left trees. Mm-hmm. If it was a dog leg right, you know, he could never kind of play it the way he was always going to try to hit the miracle shot and the best shot. And just because he could probably. And he got a little better at that. And then he got some status and always felt if he could get out there, he'd be really good. And the tour courses are made for him where you got to kind of hit it. And I thought, oh man, if he gets out there, he'll do great. And he spent last year at the Floridian, he came over, he just had a baby and hadn't been home. And he got home that night before and he came over and we had a practice round at maybe 1 o'clock and he stayed over there from 1 till 6. And I kept telling him, hey man, go home. And he's like, nah, I'm really enjoying this. He's telling the guys, well, remember, cause this is only like a year or two removed from him playing there. Hey, the pin will be here. And, you know, just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And so appreciative of Wake Forest. He was a hockey player. You know, he's kind of got the big, big, strong legs and butt, and which is important in the golf swing. And putts well. Doesn't seem like he's the lights are too bright or the stage is too big. And he's definitely, I've kind of found this through the years, he's kind of a mumbler in the fact that, you know, good players kind of mumble to themselves like, oh yeah, I can't believe how did I miss that, but, you know, they kind of mumble to themselves to keep going, opposed to where others will get too emotional or too whatever. But he expects a lot of himself, which is great. And he's been unbelievable since he's graduated. And
a couple of things that occurred to me there. One, coaches need to invite their former players back so they can speak into the lives of their current players about how important the experience was being at school. That's awesome. And it gives them an opportunity to give back. And number two, if the kids could only understand, that's not that far away from me. If I'll work, if I'll do it, that's where I want to be too. It's a really, really powerful thing, I think. Earlier, you mentioned that your favorite aspect of coaching was what you had learned from Coach Haddock, which was the competition. I mean, let's get them ready to go play the competition. And you love that. I still do, too. We don't go for another couple of weeks, and we play at the Aggie Invitational in College Station. I mean, I'm excited about that. And we both are. We both love that experience. But if I made you the commissioner of college golf, I mean, you're a czar for a day of college golf, what are you going to, that's because you've already told me what your favorite aspect of it is. What would be something you would change on day one?
Well, and it may be in all sports, but I would change this transfer rule. The fact that you can just, you know, oh, coach looked at me the wrong way, or oh, I should have qualified and I didn't, and coach didn't take me. And so now I'm going to transfer. And it's kind of in all sports where I think you have to fail. I think you have to struggle. I think you have to, you know, life's not all just peaches and cream. I mean, it's going to have incredible amount of ups and downs. And there is no better sport than ours that we coach in golf that mimics life, in my opinion. I mean, there's a moment every time you play that you have to make a decision. There's just so much. You've got to balance. You got to be accountable. You got to do this. You got to be that. Just like being a parent, just like being a relationship, whatever it is. And they run from it. If any little adversity, they run from it. I think back to when I played. I called my parents once a month from a house phone in the hall and just to let them know basically I was alive, you know. And I'm sure they knew I was fine, but you know, now it's just, I mean, it's, you know, anytime goes something wrong, you call the parents, so you text somebody, or you, you know, there's always somebody there to make you feel better, opposed to, okay, how do I figure this out? How do I use my teammates? How do I ask my coach? How do I got a friend? How do I kind of work through this to make me better at it? So I would definitely change the fact that they can just, I mean, there's a ton in the portal in every sport. And, I think, if not off the subject here a little bit, but the blue bloods like the Kentuckys and the Dukes, they're going to have a hard time because they get the 18-year-olds and they get the best. But now you're going to go play against a team that's got three pretty good players, but all of a sudden we bring in a 22 and a 23-year-old that are fourth and fifth year guys that transfer in. They're better than those 18-year-olds. That's a big difference in any sport. They're tougher. They're mentally better. They're calmer. They're whatever. So. The transfer rule, make them sit out like they used to. That way they'll make a decision where they want to go and they'll live. Now, if the coach leaves or there's something, circumstances, then obviously you could let them out of that. But once they make the commitment, then come on, let's play.
I'm with you. And also, if a player has a conflict with you, the coach, part of really kind of growing up and becoming an adult is to have conflict resolution. Like, Coach Haas, I don't like the way you do this. Okay, well, let's talk about this. Maybe we can figure this out. And if the two of you can't come to an agreement, then maybe he puts his name in a portal and he moves on. But right now we're just saying he didn't even have to come talk to you. He just puts his name in the portal and he's gone. It's like, we can do better than that as far as training our kids and getting them ready. So if you were czar, I'd vote for you. Can you vote for a czar?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. The czar of the telestrator, right?
Exactly.
Mike Fratello.
That's exactly it. Okay, so you mentioned a piece of advice you got earlier from Jesse Haddock, but as far as your 25 years in coaching, what's the best piece of advice another coach gave you that you think, wow, I'm glad he said that?
I would say he told me, it was actually Dwayne Knight. He said, don't leave your best team at home. And I think what he meant by that is you can have your qualifying, you can have this and that, and you got to have that for your team chemistry a little bit. At the end of the day, Mike, you know, we do the qualifier for about two or three guys at the end of the day, just to give them a chance because they're working hard or whatever. But we kind of know who our better players are, maybe five or six or seven of them. And we can't just qualify them and leave the rest out. But I always tell them, hey, if you're one of my best players and you should be in the top five, then you need to play well, like it at the tournament. Or if we do qualify, you need to be up there. You need to win those qualifiers or be right there or be up. Don't finish sixth and say, well, I beat this guy and I beat this guy last tournament and I finished 33rd. He finished 35th. And, you know, I want guys that are winning qualifiers and playing. I always remember the name Andrew McGee was a great. And I think it was Greg Gross was maybe his coach. And he said that Andrew played every qualifier. He was a first team All-American and he won college events and he was a great pro. But he always wanted to play in the qualifier. He just would come back from the night before and like, let's play in the, and he would play in the qualifiers and he won every qualifier. He just wanted to stay sharp. He wanted to play. He wanted the competition. He didn't go out the next day and say, oh, I'm tired. And because you have to learn how to play when you're tired, you have to learn when you don't learn how to play when you really don't want to play sometimes, you know, like, God, I just don't feel like playing today, but I got to, I have to produce a score. How do I do that? And it's tough, but you know, sometimes you have to make decisions and you don't want to leave your best team at home.
Great advice, Dwayne Knight. You know, I talked to JT Higgins a while back. Dwayne gave that same exact advice to JT. And I think to myself, if I'm hearing that now for the second time, it's pretty good advice, but I haven't always followed it. I've always, gosh, I want to be fair to everybody. I want, you know, all this. Well, the truth is you've got to get your best team. And if you want to be fair to somebody, how about your best player? He really wants you to have the best team, the other four guys to be good, right?
Right.
Yeah. So it's your job. Okay. That's good advice by Dwayne. Thank you for sharing. Now, something I'm going to start today whenever I have a college coach like yourself on here is if you had a super elite college player a hybrid of all the best you've ever seen in certain categories, and it could be players you've coached or players you've coached against. Give me the best player in every category: driver, iron player, wedges, putter, and mental game. Give me each one of those players.
Well, I saw him a lot each and every day. My driver would be my nephew, Bill Haas. Incredible driver of the ball. I remember one time Titleist came up here and it was making a funny noise. So they put some rat glue there in the back when they used to do that and kind of shook it in there. And we had a fence down here at the old attic that was like 310 to carry the fence. And this was back in the day. And I'm telling you what, no exaggeration, he put about 40, 50 balls in a row over that fence, just one after the other. And I can't remember who the Titleist guy was. And we kept looking at each other like, man, are we watching this? But great driver of the ball. One thing I had to do with him a little bit in college, like he would outdrive guys by 40, 50 yards. Their ball would be in the air and Bill's ball would be in the air at the same time. I'm like, but, you know, you've got a huge advantage. Just don't just slap it on there 35 feet like they did. Take your time. You're hitting wedges and they're hitting sevens and eight irons. You know, let's get a little better with our wedge play. Iron play, I didn't watch him a bunch, but when I did, and it's kind of been proven, Colin Morikawa. I watched him hit two shots in college. And he made one and he hit the other one a foot. So I heard he was pretty good, but no, I watched him on the range a little bit here and there, but Colin Morikawa would be my iron player. Wedges would be Denny McCarthy, kid that went to Virginia, tried really hard to get him here, but he ended up going to Virginia and was just a really good wedge player and made a lot of birdies. And as you know, coach, and I know that, if we can teach these kids to be better wedge players, I mean, you make 3-4 birdies a day and maybe, I don't know, you make 6 extra birdies on the tournament and you play a lot better. My putter, Maverick McNealy.
Oh, yeah.
No surprise there. He's a fabulous putter is what he is. Good kid. You could see that he was going to be a nice player. And again, one of those kids, once he got established, that would be a good player. And then my mental game is I thought long and hard on this one. I've had a lot, but I went with Chris Nallen. I love Chris. Always thought he was just the right mix of kind of mean, kind of angry, kind of happy, kind of almost had those steely eyes that he was going to look at you and you weren't going to beat him. And, you know, all these guys, kind of Maverick, Denny, Chris Nallen, all good putters, all good. You know, you can kind of intermix them, but he was always, I thought he was always a winner, always a guy that that just looked like he was in control. Not too happy, not too sad, but just kind of mean. I think you have to be a little mean in this game when you play in a good way.
No, he was mean in a good way. And honestly, when he was coaching at Arizona as an assistant, you could see the same qualities. And that's, I think, why he was a good assistant coach. Okay, that's the first super elite college player. I'm going to start doing that with coaches going forward. We'll see how this comes out. If you could put that group together, that would be a Tiger Woods, I think. It'd be pretty good.
I'd have to get them a great NIL deal to come.
You would have to do that. Well, Jerry, thanks so much for spending an hour with me. You were incredible, but I knew you would be. And I want to wish you the best of luck, you and your team, the rest of this spring. Probably won't see you at any tournaments, so let's just make it Greyhawk. That'd be a good place to see each other.
I'd love to see you there at Greyhawk, and we'll have a Coca-Cola together.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it again. Thanks a lot, and best of luck for the rest of the spring.
Coach McGraw, you are I have your book right over here. You are one of my favorite people, not just the coach, but you're always done it the right way. I remember walking with you at Sun River there when you won your national championship, and that was even though we didn't get you there, I was very happy for you.
Well, thank you so much. All right, Jerry. Thanks again. We'll see you.
See you, Mike. Bye.
Bye.